Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good afternoon, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We really appreciate you taking time today to join us for Midrats, whether you're with that elite group live or you're just catching us on the podcast later. If you're with us live and you are so inclined, if you scroll to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find the chat room, where if you have some observations you'd like to make during the course of the show, or if there is a question you would like to direct to our guest that doesn't appear that we're headed that way, that's the perfect place to do it. I'll be keeping an eye on it during the course of the show and would love the opportunity to bring your ideas into the conversation. And if you got to take off, during the show, and you want to see what you missed, you can always go back over to Blog Talk Radio and get the full archive, or just take a shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes or Stitcher. Now let's get on with the show, and today we're going to take a little bit of break from our normal format. Now and then we will throw together a panel discussion, and that's exactly what we've done today. And we've put together just a great, great panel of Midrats veterans, if I dare say, to talk about an upcoming event that I think we have a large overlap in the Venn diagram between navalists and science fiction lovers. And coming up next month on the November 18th, as a Saturday, from noon to 5 p.m. Eastern, the Naval Academy Museum, via their director, Claude Barabé, is going to husband what really looks to be a original, entertaining and informative conference called NavyCon. In NavyCon, you're going to see a discussion from a variety of players that we're going to talk about today that kind of connect how fleet forces have been portrayed in science fiction, compare that to what we see in the Navy, and how that information flow cross-pollinates both fiction and reality. I mentioned before that our guests today are all Midrat veterans. Of course, we have Claude is on with us. We also have two other people who are going to be speakers at NavyCon. We're going to have senior fellow at the Center for CNAS, Jerry Hendricks, Captain U.S. Navy retired, and also Mark Vandroff. He's the CO of NSWC Carterock, and he's a former DDG-51 program manager. Everybody, we appreciate you taking time this beautiful East Coast day. Welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Hey, and I want to go ahead and kick it over to Claude to start off with, and just kind of a general question for you. Why NavyCon, and where did this idea come from?
Sure. Well, earlier this year, Congress was debating under the advancement of Congressman Mike Rogers and Congressman Cooper, Space Corps. And back in June, Lieutenant Matt Hipple had written a piece in the National Interest on why the Navy ought to have the Space Corps rather than the Air Force, as has been proposed. Well, when Matt wrote that, you and I and folks listening know that Twitter can be kind of an angry verse rather than just a Twitterverse. But this is a case where we started kicking around ideas, and those of us who are of a certain age, Jerry and Mark and I are all about the same age, and we were recalling from our youth, you know, not only the Star Wars and Star Trek, but we were remembering Star Blazers with the space battleship Yamato, and realize that there actually is a case to be made for a Space Corps falling under the Navy. Based on all these shows, why is it in the future that we don't see a Space Air Force or a Star Air Force or a Star Army? It's always fleets and captains and admirals. So I actually took this offline from Twitter, and I bounced the idea off of Mark and Jerry and a couple of other people initially. I said, hey, you know, why don't we have something like a sci-fi convention of our own? I'll host it at the museum. And Mark was the first to chime in, said, yep, I'll do it. Jerry was right behind him. And then it just sort of went from there. We got about we've got 13 speakers, including the three of us, talking on a variety of space series on TV and in the movies, in books, etc. So I think it's a real interesting, diverse collection of presenters and topics.
As you let me throw this out generally, but as you guys look at this, was the which comes first in your minds, the some of the TV shows, the Star Treks and Battlestar Galacticas and that, or some of the books you might have read that would prompt your interest in science fiction as an issue of national security? Anyone? Bueller?
Well, this is Jerry. And, you know, on a daily basis, even at my office, you know, there's kind of an ongoing debate between me and one of my colleagues, you know, of Star Wars versus Star Trek, you know, and, you know, who wins in the overall, you know, scheme of the universe. I think I was first excited by the ideas of watching Star Trek as a youngster. But at the same time, I think that a lot of my thoughts when it comes to strategy, and as a naval officer, actually derived from a lot of the things I'd read, be it Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card, or the topic that I actually chose to speak on, which will be David Weber's books on Honor Harrington. I think the TV and the movies got it started for me, but the books definitely went far deeper in their exploration of strategy and tactics.
Yeah, this is Mark. I'll pile on to what Jerry said. I became a science fiction fan early on in a kind of a two-track manner. I was a huge fan of the original Star Trek series, not old enough to remember when it was first on, but saw it in its early reruns. And then I was, as an early reader, I was a big fan of the Isaac Asimov series, the robot series. So that got me reading science fiction and watching science fiction. I personally, my talk will be about Star Wars, not Star Trek, but I love both franchises. In many ways, I love them both equally. And I really, I think that it makes for, in some ways, a more accessible form of fiction than going out and reading something that might be a little bit more academic and obscure. Everyone can get into science fiction.
Yeah, and this is Claude. I concur with both Jerry and Mark. My earliest recollections were the old Star Trek series, but in terms of discussing fleet operations and strategies, I'm more of a Star Trek Deep Space Nine guy because the original series was more tactical. You really didn't have fleet actions. You may have had one minor squadron action in the original series when the Enterprise took on four other starships in an episode. But like Jerry, I was highly influenced the past decade by David Weber's Honor Harrington series, which I'd recommend to anybody. The level of detail Weber goes into, I initially thought he was a retired naval officer, probably an intel officer, because he goes into a lot of things about Office of Naval Intelligence in this future. But I was really excited that David Weber himself decided that he was going to join us for this. So in addition to having science fiction readers, we're also going to have authors like David Weber.
And I have hey, Claude, to thank Jerry and Claude. I had never heard of David Weber until we started to plan this. And I just finished Basilic Station, which is a great read, and I'm just starting The Honor of the Queen, the second novel in the series. But so I've now been turned on. I am an up-and-coming David Weber fan.
And Claude, I think that's a great lead-in to something about NavyCon itself that I think should get even people who maybe are mild science fiction fans or the occasional science fiction fans, or gets, you know, the pop science fiction. Usually when you speak about it, it's Star Wars or Star Trek, and you all have mentioned a couple of the other above the fold items, you know, Starship Troopers, Ender Game, maybe Honor Harrington, people have heard of. But there's a whole universe of science fiction which for the not just the Navy, but the military professional. You can see a little bit of cross-pollinization or at least interest there. And I think that you and your team have done a really good job on covering that whole introspection that brought aboard, especially for a first kickoff of an event, and who knows whether there'll be ones in the future, but you've managed to bring on an astronaut, a serving congressman. So for the listener, describe a little bit the lineup you have for NavyCon so you can get a flavor of the very broad and diverse universe of science fiction that you're going to bring into the afternoon.
Sure. Well, we're really excited about the lineup. Our kickoff speaker is Captain Kay Heyer, Naval Academy Class of 81, who was an astronaut on two missions. And so she's really going to talk about the Navy and space today and tomorrow. We've got a series of panels. We've got a couple of bloggers. We've got Raymond Pritchett of Information Dissemination. We've got Commander B.J. Armstrong, Captain Jonathan Bratton, and they're going to Raymond is going to pick up on early science fiction video games. The non-state actor is obviously going to play a role in this. We've got The Expanse and Firefly, which are going to be covered by those guys. And so, you know, Firefly is an extraordinarily popular or was an extraordinarily popular series over a decade ago. But The Expanse is running right now, and that's why I'm very excited that somebody's taking on that approach. We've got somebody from the U.S. Navy Museum downtown in D.C. who's going to cover Battlestar Galactica, Jennifer Marland. And as you mentioned, we've got Congressman Mike Gallagher. He's a first-time congressman from Wisconsin who is on the House Armed Services Sea Power Subcommittee, and he is a Marine Corps veteran from Iraq, and he's going to speak on service duty and Starship Troopers. Most of the ones that we've got covered right now, and we're just extraordinarily excited about all 13 folks who are able to join us and give us their perspectives. And I should also mention David Larder, he was a former sailor, and David is now a reporter. You've all read his work, so we're really excited that he can bring his perspective on leadership in the Star Wars universe. So I'd say we cover about seven or eight different topics. It's not just about Star Wars or Star Trek. Tim Choi is joining us from he's coming down from Canada. He's a PhD candidate. And he's going to cover Star Trek Deep Space Nine on sea lanes and choke points.
Speaking of sea lanes and choke points, one of the in David Weber's other series, the Safehold series, I don't know if you all read that, but it is like a primer on, and Claude, you ought to like this, a primer on, or BJ ought to like this, on Mahan's Sea Power book. Is there a discussion of that too, or is this are you going to focus mostly on the Honor Harrington thing, do you think?
Well, Jerry's going to do Honor Harrington, and David hasn't told me what he's going to talk about. He knows what the theme is, and if he doesn't discuss his other series, then I would expect that would come up during the Q&A session.
And Jerry, speaking of what people are speaking on, take a moment and outline for the listener what you'll be speaking of over at NavyCon.
Well, it was, you know, there was a broad, diverse topics to grow, you know, to grab from. And I thought about the standards. I even thought about doing the Battlestar Galactica because I'd been so entranced with the new revamped series a few years ago because of its sense of reality. But I chose to go back to Harrington mostly because I wanted to talk about some themes that emerged all the way through the Harrington series. Which was essentially a kind of a repeat of the Jean Ecole or the new school approach to naval strategy, naval technology, and naval tactics, because Weber writes about this tension, this dynamic tension between everyone who wants to go with the newest, latest technology and think that war can be reinvented against a more conservative, almost aristocratic approach to war, which says that, you know, war is what it has always been. And so all the way through the novels, there's this tension between the introduction of these new technologies And then the idea that in the end, the wall of battle is really going to be something that's going to be critical in winning that ultimate fight. And I really want to explore that tension in my topic of conversation.
Well, that's pretty good. And you're going to talk about Starship Troopers, I gather. So let's talk about Heinlein is one of the founding fathers of military science fiction. I guess you're not going to talk about that. You're going to talk about something else.
Right.
What are you going to talk about? I've gone off track here. Sorry.
So Congressman Gallagher is going to talk about Starship Troopers, and I'm really looking forward to that because that's also one of my favorite books. I'm a big Heinlein fan. My talk is actually inspired in part by my last appearance here on Midrats. We were talking about my previous article, one of my previous articles about being a program manager, and we talked a little about acquisition reform. And the 2009 WASERA legislation. And one of the things that legislation did was create an office within the Office of Secretary of Defense called PARCA, Program Assessment and Root Cause Analysis. And what Congress tasked this office to do was look at failed programs and figure out why they failed. What went wrong when an acquisition program didn't turn out right? And then a few years ago, when Frank Kendall was the undersecretary, he actually added to their charter, and he said, it's not good just to study when a program goes wrong. He actually had this office study what happens when a program goes right, when we have a program that we agree really satisfied the warfighter's needs and did so on cost and on budget. And so what went right about that program? They started writing reports about that, and Parker's reports are really very good and very insightful. And you know, there's something to read for people for whom defense acquisition is their profession. And so when I heard Claude's idea of what are we going to do with this, it immediately my presentation is as if I were PARCA and the Death Star was a program. So I am doing the PARCA analysis on the Death Star. What went right? What went wrong? I'm using material from the movies Rogue One. And episodes 4, 5, 6 put together to see what did the Empire do right, what did the Empire do wrong, what can we learn, and like any other program, the lessons you learn from what went right and wrong from the Death Star in some ways are universal truths about what goes right and what goes wrong whenever you try and build a complicated system to satisfy the warfighter's needs.
That's absolutely beautiful. And I want to go ahead and throw a question. I want to just free range off of that whole concept, because one of the questions I wanted to throw at Jerry, if we have time, someone to make time, is let's spend some time in the Star Wars universe, because when you look at the Empire just really likes very big, very expensive. If it fails once, that means we didn't do it hard enough, so let's try again type of fleet. Whereas the Rebel Alliance seems not just it's ragtag because they come from a variety of areas, but they have a very diverse ships, not just Star Destroyers, Star Cruisers, or just let's just make it four times larger type of warships. So, you know, Jerry, have you ever had a chance to look at the for lack of a better phrase, the fleet design difference you see with the Empire in Star Wars versus what you see with the Rebel Alliance, and anything that has kind of tickled your fancy from that point of view?
It's funny that you ask this question. I teach a course in the fall semester at Georgetown University, along with a former colleague of mine, on how to do net assessments, and you know, based upon my experience of working in the Office of Net Assessment. And so we have a set of graduate students, generally no more than 15, but we bring them all together and we ask them to essentially choose a net assessment to write. And it's always fun for me because these students come from a broad, diverse background. And this year, one of our students, who's actually an active serving officer, I believe in the Army, approached me and said, I want to do a net assessment between the X-Wing and Y-Wing fighters versus the TIE fighter. And we actually went back and forth on the design of his net assessment, because generally you don't go tank on tank in a net assessment. You look for the asymmetric advantage. And so we devolved into a conversation about the emplaced pulse laser emplacements on the Death Star versus the fleet design, and exactly where does the Millennium Falcon and all the pickup fleet sort of fall within this. And so the net assessment is developing. The student is actually writing this now. I have to say this is a particular assignment that I'm watching perhaps closer than the other 14 members of the class, just simply because it's an area of interest that I would love to do myself, but I haven't been able to do. But you know, applying sort of classic Andrew W. Marshall approaches to the Galactic Empire versus the Rebel Alliance is something I'm having a bit of fun with via the student.
You know, he's going to have to wind up publishing that someplace significant, because simply because I want to read it. Over to you.
Well, honestly, I can't wait to actually have the student debrief it to Mr. Marshall. That may be a conversation I want to set up.
I just want to rise in defense of the Empire for just one moment, but and do so in a way to offer a thought. It's easy to take away from the movies, oh, man, the stupid Empire, they just keep building Death Star after Death Star. Remember that, and this will be kind of one of the points I make, strategy drives requirements. The U.S. Navy is criticized by some of why do you keep building aircraft carriers, and one of the reasons is, well, we seem to have a requirement to do force projection, and that's the best way to do it. If you're an empire trying to rule by fear and you need to blow up planets in order to keep order, then you start building things to blow up planets. And the question is, are you building the right things to blow up planets? Are you doing that? Is that your most efficient option? What's your supply chain? But in the end, when you keep asking, you know, why are you keep building those things, if your strategic goals demand that you go buy a capability, then that's what you go buy.
Let the record show that the man that helped give birth to the Flight 3 Arleigh Burke class destroyer supports the Flight 3 Death Star. Claude, I think you had a comment.
Yeah, actually, I think that's a fascinating comment by Mark, and I'm looking forward to him following up at NavyCon. But if you take something, say, from the Star Trek universe with regard to Star Trek Deep Space Nine and how the shipbuilding... Well, it's the only series that has hundreds and hundreds of ships engaged in major battles, Jerry. So it's great to see it from that perspective. But you see at the beginning of the Dominion War what happens with swarm tactics, and when the Jem'Hadar actually take one of their standard ships and sail it right into a galaxy class starship. It takes out the ship with 1,000 crew members like that. But what really survives throughout most of the series are the Defiant class ships of about 40 people, smaller, tougher, like Benjamin Sisko said, with teeth, rather than simply something with forward presence and exploratory capability. I almost wanted to riff off of Jerry's article of Build Fords, Not Ferraris, and give a talk called Build Defiance, Not Galaxies.
Well, that would have been fun. Let me go back to something that Mark talked about a second ago, which is supply chains. One of the interesting aspects of science fiction is sometimes the logistics flow is magic. You got replicators and you can produce anything. And sometimes they really do go into a more serious discussion of the need to replenish either dilithium crystals or missiles and stuff. But let's talk a little bit about that in terms of the role that science fiction and the discussion of logistics is.
You want to take that, Jerry, or should I hop in?
No, you go ahead, Mark.
So without all I will say about my talk, and I don't want to give away too much, is that I address logistics in Star Wars. But in general, I think my comment back to you, Eagle, is that's one of the things that makes a difference between a really great science fiction franchise and one that's maybe not so good. One of the reasons that I've enjoyed the first and now I'm into the second of the David Weber books of the Honor Harrington is that he creates a very detailed and self-consistent universe where they may not have our logistics problems, but they have their own challenges and their own limitations that they have to overcome, and they can't just snap a finger and create their way out of a problem, that the book hangs together in a self-consistent whole, even if it is a speculative or fictional universe. And I think if you have we'll just replicate that and get on with the story in order to make the plot move, then I think that really does the reader a disservice in that genre, and that the franchises that have that depth, that create that need to really explore the entire life cycle of what it's like to live in that fictional universe through either the books or the movies or the television shows, what have you, of that fictional franchise, that's the ones that are really worth exploring, and that's what really gets the fans.
Yeah, I'll pick up on that because this is one of the things I really love about Weber. Weber does not gloss over the fact that that the underlying importance of sea power or space power in his case is all about trade, and it's all about trade lines between alliances and between, in his case, planets and systems. In our case, you know, nation states, islands, and so on, you know, scattered around the globe. You know, he comes up with realistic, you know, countervailing powers. And the Navy that as represented by the Royal Manticoran Navy or the, you know, RMN, is there to protect trade. It's really about networking together things. So, as the books go on, I mean, it starts out with, you know, Basilisk Station, and trade is protecting a trade choke point. And then later it goes into ideas about convoy raiding and so on. All the different aspects are from maritime power are translated into space power, and it's a very interesting read.
Yeah, Jerry, you're starting to break up a little bit there at the end. Claude, kind of to get a big theme here, I think what is interesting about the science fiction genre, and being the fiction writer that you are in the group, I guess we can give a plug for the Connor Stark series. Start with Aiden Effect and then go on to Siren Song. But some people have said that the science fiction genre kind of took over the place in the imagination that used to be held by the Western. And though they did have an overlap a fair bit there, I think that's probably a pretty accurate critique because you don't see very many Westerns now. While you do see a lot of science fiction the last 50 to 75 years, maybe simply because it gives people more options to explore. But you know, what do you think is the power of science fiction to attract what is really a much more diverse crowd of readers than many people would suspect?
I think there's two answers to that. Number one, that there has been science fiction for a long time, even before the movies of the teens, 20s, and 30s and 40s really came out with the Western. Let's remember that, you know, H.G. Wells is coming out with War of the Worlds. You've got books about submarines of the future with atomic power. There's an interesting story. In 1938, as War of the Worlds is going on the radio with Orson Welles, there's a midshipman at the Naval Academy who had a radio in his room and had missed the first couple of minutes. And he ends up going down to the armory and demanding, along with a number of other midshipmen, that they break out weapons in order to fight off the Martians. And his, the company officer stopped him in time and said, "Well, how do you know this?" He says, "Well, I've got a radio in my room. It's all over." He says, "Well, number one, that's a radio show. It's fiction. And number two, you're going to get some demerits because you're not supposed to have a radio in your room." And that midshipman was Ed Beach, who would end up commanding the Triton for the first circumnavigation submerged around the world, and would write "Run Silent, Run Deep." But I think to the broader question, I think it's because of the what the Vulcan philosophy would say: infinite diversity and infinite combinations. It goes to our basic humanity. Everything that we deal with in science fiction goes back to humans. It's about human decision making. It's about human courage. It's about human failings. And when we're reading these stories about in science fiction, it's not just the technologies that capture our imagination. You know, Han Solo had, yeah, the Millennium Falcon, but as a character, he was far more interesting, arguably, than the Millennium Falcon, as was Princess Leia. You can say that with, why is Kirk so appealing, even more, perhaps more so than the Enterprise? It's about character. And so when we study these issues, especially at NavyCon, you know, it's not an unserious environment, because these are the same issues we deal with today, the same human failings, the same human decision-making, the same human courage that we see on a day-to-day basis in the United States Navy.
Yeah, let me jump in on that if I could. And because you juxtapose the two genres there of the Western and science fiction, and the Western was more popular in the past, and why science fiction is more popular today. Understand that the Western was Americans looking back at the exploration and the settlement of the West and what that was, and to the degree the West helped to define the American character. And today, with the frontier settled for now over a century, the fact is that science fiction is defining still that American sense of exploration and the wanting to reach outward and to redefine themselves. So to the extent that the Western defined American character in the past, you know, Shane, sort of the responsible individual, you know, James T. Kirk today and Han Solo recognizes that American spirit being projected essentially onto a new landscape in space.
And I'd like to pile on to what Claude and Jerry just said and generalize it a step further. A few months ago, SimSec was nice enough to publish one of my essays in which I argued that engineers, and especially engineers who work in defense, ought to read the classics. They ought to read the Bible, and they ought to read Aristotle, and they ought to read Plato and Virgil and Homer, because exactly what we talked about, it was an insight to the human condition, and that you couldn't be a good engineer and you couldn't really learn to satisfy a customer's needs with technology unless you understood our common humanity. And I think that why I argued for the classics is that those works stand the test of time. Now, science fiction, although it's been around a long time, maybe, you know, it doesn't have the 3,000 years that Homer has. But what it lacks in centuries, it makes up for both in accessibility and the ability to spark the modern imagination. So it's very much in the same vein that reading great science fiction or watching a great science fiction genre, either in television or in film, accesses certain truths about people, and those truths are useful no matter what you're doing.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because a lot of science fiction today seems to involve preparations or lack of preparations to receive an alien force arriving on our doorstep, so to speak. So, you know, that argues for sort of a militarization of space. But the other side of that is if all these commercial ventures where people are talking about going to Mars and the moon and setting up communities or colonies, does that argue for, once again, going back and looking at the lines of communication and the defense of those against anyone who would want to disrupt such colonies?
Yeah, I would just chip in that on that one, Sal, that, or is that Sal or Eagle?
That was Eagle.
That was Eagle. Sorry, Eagle. So what I would chip in on that is that, sure, a colony in space needs internal and external defenses just as long as human evil exists. If we ever found a way to cure human evil, then we would not need the profession of defense. But if we get to a point when humanity takes to the stars at some point in the future, now we're discussing it as fiction, but if it ever became fact, we're going to end up taking our human nature with us. And that frail human nature will come with us, and we will have all the same challenges and all the same pathologies in space that we would have here on Earth.
Yeah, and I'd actually add on to Mark's comment, because Sal, you and I have had some chats about this current show, The Expanse. That's not necessarily something that has a focus on alien life, although there is a small aspect. But what happens is, as people colonize the solar system, there is this intrinsic disagreement between, say, Mars and Earth. Mars gets its own sense of nationality. The people in the asteroids get their own nationality. So Mark's right. Just because you may not have an external threat doesn't mean you don't need some sort of internal maritime security structure, especially in light of the potential for civil wars.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I think along with a colleague of mine at CNAS, we just published a recent report called A Space Policy for the Trump Administration, where we talk about the fact that the flag follows trade. And we are really just on the brink of really seeing commercial development of, you know, mining and asteroids and doing some mining on the moon and so on. And I think this is another thing that this idea of an independent space force is beginning to gain traction, because we know that we're beginning to look outward. And the moment that commercial competition makes it into space, or you start getting a colony someplace on the moon or on Mars or someplace else, there's going to be a need for security. The flag will follow whatever we do. And so, you know, science fiction is already helping us to plot that path. And we almost, anyways, I like what Mark had to say, you know, the human condition, it's been rather constant. That's the one thing that anyone who studies the classics understands, is essentially the same thing over and over again. And there's not much chance of that changing. And, you know, I think it's nothing but the thing that happens to the armature.
Jerry, you've broken up to the point I think everybody's probably lost sync on you. We'll give you a chance to reset, maybe get to a stronger area. So Mark, let me roll a question your way. From the point of view of a program manager and an engineer's perspective, when you look at the universe of different science fiction that we look at, what gives you cramps from rolling your eyes so much that you all of us are embarrassed to watch it? And who do you think, or what universe do you think kind of gets it right when it comes to how engineering works, how ships work, building ships, maintaining ships, things of that manner?
So that's interesting. The first one is obviously all science fiction that deals with space has to create some new science out there about how to overcome the whole faster than the speed of light thing. I think David Weber does it in a pretty clever way. They've got, you know, he's got the hyperspace. Star Trek has its warp drive. Star Wars has a jump to hyperspace that gets you how to get between planets in a reasonable amount of time, even though they're separated by many, many years, if you were going to be constrained by the speed of light. So everyone's got to come up with a fiction to get around that. I really don't have a favorite. But what I love about the engineering, and this goes right back to the original, there is something about the characteristic of, in the original Star Trek, of Scotty's love for his plant. The fact that it was his, and the pride that he took in it, and the level of ownership that he had, that is universal among all good engineers. I gave a talk a few years ago at the Defense Acquisition University. Whenever your program gets on, the DOD gives out a couple of what they call Packard Awards every year for the outstanding DOD program. And when your program wins a Packard Award, you get to go to DAU and talk about it. And I told the people there in the room full, I said, if you're a service acquisition executive or you're a program executive officer, if your program managers don't scare you a little bit with the level of passion they have about their product, then you don't have the right program managers. And Star Trek, of all the series, captured that the best. Their engineers cared deeply about the thing that they were taking care of, and you could see that in the fiction, and it came through. So I give that kind of the high water mark from science fiction.
Well, I want to go back to commerce protection a little bit, because it is an interesting question to me that as we look at some very wealthy people now looking at mining asteroids, and there have been a number of years and years and years ago, I read a short story about, or maybe a short book on novelette, on guys using inflatable spacecraft to get out to the asteroid belt and mine the asteroids. Since I'm a lot older than you guys, it was before Star Wars and Star Trek. What is the best approach? I mean, do you kind of go with the Coast Guard, look at, you know, here, have somebody inspect their gear before they go, and then stand by to protect them if there are claim jumpers, so to speak? Or when do you need a naval size force as opposed to something like the Coast Guard to defend the commerce lanes in space?
Well, can you guys hear me better now?
Much.
Okay. I think that when you get beyond essentially a single space lane where you're going from one port of call to the next port of call and it essentially is a binary system, in that situation, it's rather constabulary. But when you get into intersecting webs of lines of communication from various nodes and points, where there could be, essentially pirates that are hanging out in the middle or someone who's raiding on the outpost, numerous outposts, where you can't have centers of gravity either here or there, but in many places. At that point in time, you move beyond constabulary and you begin to look at the need for a real naval requirement. And you can see that both in ancient maritime history with the Greeks, and you can see that in the future, with things like, quite frankly, with the Battlestar Galactica universe, where they had multiple battlestars and multiple colonies, and that was what drove the growth of the colonial fleet to things like the Harrington series, or even, for that matter, the United Federation of Planets. That was more about exploration than anything else. They seemed to poo-poo the ideas of commerce. But the fact is I think that that's when you go to a larger naval structure.
I think it's also going to depend on what factions you're dealing with. I mean, let's just call this out and say in terms of 50 to 100 years, if you're dealing with two or three superpowers that each have rights and claims to various asteroids and moons throughout the solar system, you can foresee a space navy's developing. But if you have a united Earth front trying to do that, I'm not sure you're going to need those large navies. You're going to look at smaller ships, which are capable of those Coast Guard cutters, if you will, that are capable of protecting your commerce from piracy, which, again, you know, you go back to Thucydides and you'll see piracy back then. So it's not something that's going to go away simply because we change the ocean.
I think what's also kind of powerful about science fiction, you kind of go back to really one of the founding fathers of the modern science fiction genre, H.G. Wells, in his, I think he wrote it in before, right at the beginning of the First World War, 1913, 1914, in The World Set Free. He predicted nuclear weapons, nuclear war, how that impact might be. And we've talked a little bit about The Expanse that I believe was we were catching up on it the first episode that had a rail gun. Claude, I think I sent a message to you very excitedly going, rail guns, rail guns, they have rail guns. And, of course, you see missiles. Star Trek has photon torpedoes. We've seen in Rogue One the ion torpedoes in the Star Wars genre. What is the connection or how does a writer look at, as Wells did, at the very dawn of nuclear technology and theory, can see something that they read and quickly extrapolate that along the development curve decades down the road and get it so right? And if, is there some science fiction, maybe that we haven't talked about right now, that you think the author has had the ability to do something like that, see something that's just in the midst of understanding, has been able to extrapolate that into the future really well?
Well, I can
sorry about
question.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I was on mute for a second. I think you could just start off going with the 6-1, 6-2, and 6-3 projects over at the Office of Naval Research, just going down that list and seeing, okay, what are the potential applications of these research projects, applied research, basic research? You have that to some degree now, and that's why I would suggest that NavyCon isn't, you know, simply a fun little event we're having. This is, these are some ideas that we're throwing out, not that aren't dissimilar to what the Marine Corps Warfighting Lab and the Atlantic Council have done recently with their futures project, their science fiction futures project. It's taking those small items and trying to think differently, and I think that's what's probably most exciting about science fiction, is that they can take these ideas. You know, just this past week, The Orville, which is a new science fiction show, it's kind of lighthearted, but based on Star Trek, found a society that had no justice system. In fact, one guy is arrested, and the guy said, "Are you my lawyer?" He said, "No, I'm your publicity agent. I'm here for your apology tour." And everybody was pressing buttons up or down if they liked you. It's kind of like Twitter or anything else. And it's like, okay, they went in a completely different direction about how a society might evolve based on that one technology.
You know, it's interesting about science fiction and books provide a prism for individuals to look at the world. And you know, in my own case, when I did my command tours in 05, Ender's Game was sort of a book that I asked all of my officers to read, and even most of my enlisted read some of the short stories associated with it as a means of looking at the idea of how innovative culture and how to take a little and trying to get a lot out of it. Something apropos of the 2007 timeframe. One of the things I found interesting in dealing with, you know, for instance, in research about SpaceX and Elon Musk, its founder, is that Musk tends to look, and the Rosetta Stone for understanding his view is Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy. It's something apparently that was really impacting on him. And if you want to know where Elon Musk is really at when he's thinking about Mars, he is thinking about that thought of how to get mankind through a crisis point and how to have a backup plan, which is really what Foundation was in the end. Essentially having multiple redundant plans for the continuance of the species. And I always found that interesting that once I realized that he had that and that was his context, his lens for looking at things, it made it a lot easier to read his statements and understand where he was coming from and going to.
Yeah, and I would just add on to what, or maybe not add on, but diverge a little from Jerry and Claude's last couple of statements. Wonderful. Not that I would disagree with a word, but in my mind, science fiction, if I want to go read reports from the Office of Naval Research, I can do that. My favorite parts of science fiction are what it says about what's true for us here today. And I know we've been talking about the Weber books, and I just, as a newcomer to it, my favorite part of the first book of Basilic Station, I won't give away any spoilers for those who haven't read it, but my favorite part was at the end where one of the villains of the story, a Manticoran captain named Pavel Young, that in the end, what meant the most, they couldn't court-martial him, but all of his peers knew what he was at the end, and he was shunned by his fellow captains throughout the fleet. And I think about, when I read that, I thought about what the respect of my peers, and I think for any naval officer who's had command, what the respect of their peers in command means to them and how much they work to maintain the respect of their peers. And the way that just little phrase of how he lost that, how that came out in the book so perfectly, that it reflected on something that was very true about people who are in the profession of arms.
Yeah, I would add that Heinlein predicted a lot of stuff in his books, and I started reading him when I was very young as a kid on Guam, and I think I checked out Space Cadet more than any other person in that library ever history. But you know, the cell phone, all that kind of stuff, and the ability to monitor your troops in the field, things that we're just getting on the edge of now were foreseen by him in Starship Troopers, among other books, which raises the issue to me of in the future. I mean, right now we're wrestling with cyber warfare. How bad, how can it look in the future? Why is that never discussed or is it discussed in Star Wars, Star Trek, and all these other works?
Well, I think it is. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Jerry.
No, Mark, but I was going to say the end of Rogue One is one big cyber hack. When you think about it, right? For those who have seen Rogue One, they download a file and send it off. That's what the whole story of Rogue One is ultimately one big cyber hack.
Yeah, and Star Trek Next Generation is dealing with cyber issues all the time as well. And generally with science fiction, you see it going one of two ways: something that enables you to do good things, whether they're positive holodeck training experiences to figure out how the Enterprise's warp drive was built so you can find out what the issues are, or you see it going the opposite way with Nomad, it was a sort of like a Voyager, but they ended up having the V'ger system in the Star Trek motion picture. You have people like androids like Data, which is a very positive thing, but you also have his brother Lore, who is not a positive android. So in the future, as it's portrayed in a lot of science fiction, it can go either way. Look at what happens to the Colonial Fleet when in that pilot episode of the Galactica reboot, because they lose a code based on a betrayal. Essentially, the entire fleet is shut down and destroyed in one fell swoop. Only the Galactica survives simply because they had old technology.
Well, it's not true that only Galactica survived. We all know that Pegasus was also offline at that time for a reboot, and hence
point.
Did survive as well. Yeah.
Thank you. Good point.
Well, now that we have Jerry, I want to see if I can pick a fight with you here. I want to put you in a corner and have you explain today what happened to the future, because I know you're a big fan of the Navy's unmanned program and all the possibilities it has going forward. But when you look at the great canon of science fiction literature, there's really not much droning going on. You see, yep, there's the Clone Wars. You got the Cylons out there. You have Data, who's a nice little bit of AI kit, and everything's so clean. I keep looking for the cleaning robots, but they must go at night, so you don't ever see them
Terminator.
On the shows. But yep, you got the Terminator. So, what is it about the future that it still seems mostly human-centric, and besides a couple of dystopian scenarios, we just don't see the drones, even the tactical fighters? They're all manned.
Well, couple of things here. One, I think that there is it's not, quite frankly, as interesting to a reader to read about a bunch of soulless drones. The reader wants to engage in the human condition, and this is one of those things. I think even when you think about space exploration, we've had a number of highly successful drone sensors that have been to the outer planets and been surveying Saturn and its moons and its rings and Jupiter and so on, but it doesn't get the headlines that, for instance, having an American Navy captain, orbit the Earth for a year or nearly a year did. It's the human condition. It's the idea that we can place ourselves in their shoes and sort of imagine ourselves there that makes it interesting to us in real life or in what we want to read. However, you can't look at Isaac Asimov's entire series, iRobot, and everything that comes after that, Doris Vernaboli, within the Foundation follow-on books, and not understand that the computers and androids and those types of things are there in the background on so much of what it is that we've read. And so it's always been intriguing, but the computer is never going to be the star of a movie unless it's 2001, A Space Odyssey, which quite frankly, not a lot of people get, although I will always stop down and watch it anytime it's on my TV.
Yeah, I would. Just to throw my two cents in, I would argue that C-3PO and R2-D2 pretty much cover that in some series, and also in the Harrington novels, drones and unmanned vehicles do play a big role in the later books. So it's not quite as empty as you might think, Sal. I think you're right, and I think that one, there's a line, I can't remember it exactly, from the right stuff about no Buck Rogers, no Bucks, the excitement is having men in space, men doing things, people in space, pardon me. So that, I think that's a key issue, but let's talk a little bit about, the bandwidth issues. I'm always fascinated by the fact that nobody ever seems to have any bandwidth issues as we get into the future. Have you ever seen any indication of how they're getting around these bandwidth issues?
Well, it's interesting if you look at Horst and Scott Card and the Ender's Game series and the whole idea of the Ansible. There's always seems to be some workaround, or for that matter, even within the Honor Harrington series, there's the use of grav pulses in order to come essentially with what we would call a sort of a low frequency of means of communication, because the grav pulse can be faster than light or FTL type of communication. And so there's always a recognition that it is a restriction within it, but there's always some rather interesting way of looking at it. And quite frankly, when I read recently about that we've had detection of these grav pulses, through some rather interesting sensors that I think has just resulted in a Nobel being awarded. I of course was fully familiar with grav pulses, over 10 years ago by reading Weber. So it was kind of interesting how science fiction at least informed me. I was expecting the conversation when it came.
Yeah, and I would add that in my mind that's one of the limitations of Star Trek. They seem to communicate faster than the speed of light through something they call subspace, which is ill-defined, and yet subspace dies out on them whenever they are in a situation where getting orders from headquarters would interfere with the plot. It kind of comes and goes as with whatever the writers need to drive the plot as to whether or not they can talk and communicate faster than the speed of the ship moving from one place to another. So that gets back into my mind. One of the criteria of great science fiction is that the universe seems to logically hold together self-consistently.
You can always suspend belief for so long. Claude, as we get near the end of the hour, I'd be curious because this, we started off the show, we described a bit how NavyCon came into being as kind of was a dark room to step into, to see what the reaction would be outside of your perfect circle of acquaintances and friends. And I'm curious, what has been the reaction to NavyCon now that we're getting close to it actually take place? What you expected the reaction to be versus what it actually has come to be. And for the listeners here who really excited about NavyCon, I understand in person has already sold out, but outline as well some of the ways that people can log on and watch NavyCon as it's happening.
Sure, I'll answer the second first. I think everybody should follow the Naval Academy Museum on Facebook. We'll be providing updates as well as the links that where you can live stream it, watch it from the comfort of your home. Or you can do as apparently a couple of hundred folks from Texas A&M are going to do. They're putting it up on a giant screen in one of their theaters to watch it, because apparently Texas A&M's history department has the largest collection of science fiction manuscripts. They contacted me and said, how can we help? And we'd be interested in partnering with you in the future. So if NavyCon really gets some serious numbers, I think there's a case for us to make it for the for a second year next October, November. Been extraordinarily happy from a number of fan clubs. David Weber's fan club is incredible. They apparently several hundred people have contacted his wife for information. They wanted to come, and unfortunately, we only have a small space of about 36 seats, and that's why we decided to live stream it straight from the Naval Academy Museum.
Well, Claude, tell him how Weber actually came up on Facebook and expressed his interest.
Yeah, actually, it's funny. So I contacted his fan club, if I remember right, and they brought it up, and then he responded to something you said, Jerry, and I'm going to let it go at that, because then I recontacted them and said, I really need to get in touch with them. Would you give them my email address? But if you could go take it from there.
No, it was interesting because you had posted that I was going to appear and what I was going to be speaking about Honor Harrington and strategy and tactics. And then suddenly on Facebook, Weber comes up and says that how delighted he is and somewhat even embarrassed to be the topic of the conversation. And I'm totally flabbergasted that he's just, popped into our universe on Facebook. And then, of course, it was shortly thereafter that I think they reached out to you about him actually coming. And what a delight. Now I have to bring all my books, even the paperbacks.
Well, I have to say, in speaking with David Weber a couple of times now in planning out his trip, what a gentleman. Everything you hope for in an author like that, extraordinarily knowledgeable, but very, very humble. And I think he's going to give an incredible talk, and that's why I'm very honored that he will be at the end. And I'm really honored, Sal and Eagle One, that Mark and Jerry are joining us and taking the time to describe these issues, and everybody else who's taking the time to present at NavyCon.
Yeah, let me throw this in. I want to thank all of you guys for being here today, I'm so looking forward to this conference. I even anticipated it being a month earlier than I was supposed to be, but I'm very excited about it. I may send you some of my David Weber books to have you pass in front of him, but I can't wait for this to go forward, and I appreciate you guys being here today, and if you have any closing remarks about what you're up to next, you can deliver them now.
Sure, I'll go. I'm finishing my doctoral dissertation and going to be turning it into a book. I've got a publisher, so as soon as I defend in the spring, I'll be turning that around. And I'm working on another nonfiction book about the Navy, as well as I'm starting to write my third Connor Stark book.
I'm finishing up a report on the Future Force, just published a report on the space policy for the Trump administration. Then I'm going to start thinking about what I'm going to write about, in the next calendar year. And so just keeping busy. This whole 355 ship thing seems to have legs, so I'm enjoying going up to Capitol Hill and talking to a lot of people about that issue.
And this is Mark. We've got a lot of exciting things going on at Carter Rock. We're fortunate. We have all of our large hydrodynamic test facilities right now have Coast Guard models in them, in the David Taylor Model Basin and the Maneuvering and Seakeeping Basin. And so we're doing some great work over with the Coast Guard over the next 2 months. It's going to really Carter Rock, along with all the other great things we do for our Navy customers. Those customers up DOD. So I've been in command at Carter Rock for a little over a year. It's a great honor and a great experience, and I'm looking forward to the next 18 to 24 months finishing up my command tour there at Card Rock.
Yeah, Mark, Carter Arc is kind of like the Valhalla for naval engineers. It's quite the playpen you have there.
It is. It's geek heaven. I had some new sailors report on board this week, and I was doing their greet the CO moment, and I said they asked me about how I have at Carter Arc, and I said that every year the Naval Academy takes in people who are going to be pilots and people who are going to be Marines and people who are going to be SWOs, and full of geeks to be the Navy's geeks. Geek Nirvana is being at Carter Rock.
That's great. And Claude, Jerry, and Mark, just to build off Eagle One's comments, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, hour and change. I really look forward to NavyCon. And for all of our listeners, go over to Facebook, go over to Twitter, find the U.S. Naval Academy Museum and everything you want to know about NavyCon coming up, and hopefully Dash 2 will follow next year. It'll all be there. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sal.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, all of our listeners. I appreciate you checking in for another edition of Midrats. Until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
It's a long way to Tipperary.